ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
So it's basically raw sewage that flushes into the harbor that attracts bait fish. The bull sharks, they're drawn to the bait fish. It makes it very dangerous to be in the harbor immediately after a big storm.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find it on the ABC Listen app.
This story contains distressing content and includes some strong language. Listener discretion is advised.
The Geelong Courthouse is inside a big sandstone building near the city's railway station. There's lawyers and court staff, witnesses and defendants that come up and down the stairs and in and out through this glass entrance that looks down onto the street. This is where Luke Merrifull and Sean Bloomfield will be on trial for rape. When Elise arrives here to give evidence, she's 22 years old.
I had never appeared in court before. This is obviously my first time doing everything. So I was really anxious about how it was all going to go down and the types of questions I would be asked.
Elise walks through the glass entrance as the key prosecution witness. She's been waiting for this moment for almost 3 years. The prosecution team's warned her it won't be easy.
Just being, told, they're going to ask you these kinds of questions, they're probably going to trip you up in this kind of way, and that was a bit nerve-wracking for me.
Like other sexual assault complainants, she's given the option to give evidence via video link, so she doesn't have to be in the same room as the accused men. So when she arrives, she's led into a small, brightly lit room.
I just remember the quietness and the coldness of the room. It was just very white. The little table, the one screen, kind of like if you've ever seen on what are those shows called? Border Patrol, when they have someone that's got something dodgy in their bag, they take them to this tiny little room. It's kind of like that.
She's there with a volunteer from the court network, who she's never met before. And then the judge pops up on the screen. He introduces himself and asks the volunteer to shut the door. He tells her that the two accused men are out of view.
They had the screen pointing so I could only see the judge and the two lawyers, so I didn't see the people that hurt me, I couldn't see the jury, I couldn't see anyone else in attendance.
Because it's a sexual assault case, the court's closed for her testimony. Only the jury, the lawyers and judge, and the accused men are allowed to hear her evidence.
And so is Alison Manicky Brown, the detective leading the case. As the witnesses gather in the lobby outside the courtroom during breaks in the hearing, Alison notices something unusual.
Normally the victim and the parties and associated witnesses would be at one end and the accuser at the other end, because you obviously want to keep them separated and so forth.
But that's not what's happening here.
The witnesses that were called were actually gathering with those offenders rather than with Elise and her family. So that appeared to be a fairly clear division on where the support lay.
Alison can see where the loyalties lie, plain as day. But she's wondering, how will this all play out when these witnesses take the stand?
And what will it mean for Elise as she finally gets her day in court? I'm Charlotte King.
And I'm Andy Burns. And this is episode 4 of Hometown Boys, a 6-part series from Background Briefing.
When Elise begins her evidence from the small white room, she's racked with stress. She has hours of questioning ahead of her, and the prosecutor is first in line. He asks her to recount what happened the night of the party. Does she recall what she was wearing? What sort of drinks did she take to the party? Did she have any of the punch? And then, in excruciating detail, the prosecutor steps her through her recollection of what took place in the caravan.
It was really tough. I was just focused on what I had to do and what I had to say.
When it's time for her cross-examination, the questions get more complicated.
They put in, like, what actually happened to a certain degree, and then they'd add in something that didn't happen to try and make me agree to the whole sentence. But you have to kind of go through the motions and answer the questions and be really calm about it the whole time. So, like, internally screaming and raging, but externally being calm, like, no, actually, it didn't happen like that. It happened this way.
She's asked about how dark the caravan was, why she said, I think I've been raped, to a friend on the phone in the minutes afterwards, rather than just, I've been raped.
This actually happened. Like, I'm not crazy. This happened. And I just have to keep doing that, like, over and over and over and over and over.
After Elise's testimony, the prosecution calls a cast of characters from the party. But there are two witnesses that they're really banking on. The first one is Rosie Hutchins, Elise's best friend from school. She was the first to answer Elise's panicked phone calls after the men left the caravan. It's been years since Rosie's had contact with Elise, but Luke is still a close family friend.
Now, at 4:32 a.m, did you receive a phone call from Elise?
Yes.
And did you answer that?
Not the first one, no.
We weren't allowed to use the voices of witnesses and lawyers from the trial, so actors have read their words from the court transcript. Rosie is asked what state Elise was in.
She sounded emotional. She wasn't really telling me what had happened, though. She just wouldn't say what had happened.
Did she tell you anything about what happened?
Not that I recall.
The prosecutor takes Rosie back to her statement. He's hoping she'll help him build his case. But now she's on the stand, Rosie says she can't remember the conversations in her statement.
Did she say something to the effect of they wouldn't get out? Do you recall that?
I don't recall that being said, but I think it is in my statement, so it must have happened.
Did you have a conversation with her where she at least got out some words like they wouldn't leave?
Yes, I don't remember her saying that, though.
Okay.
The only thing I remember is that she wouldn't tell me, yes, this happened.
At this point, Judge Mullally asks the jury and the witness to leave the room.
It's a matter that needs to be sorted out, I think, ladies and gentlemen.
He wants to talk to the prosecutor because something is becoming clear to him. Rosie Hutchins's evidence isn't going well for the prosecution. And just a note that the judge has allowed us to use his real voice for the podcast.
It's a matter for you. I don't make your case for you. But none of what she remembers is in the statement, and everything that she put in the statement, which she said, oh, it's in the statements there, is at odds with the way she's presented it.
The judge is, in his own words, taken aback by the witness's testimony and how inconsistent it is with her original statement.
It's not for the trial judge to urge anything, but we're just leaving it where it is.
The judge tells the prosecutor that the witness could be categorised as unfavourable.
She says that she doesn't remember exact words, as if these are just common garden events that occur in 21-year-olds' lives. So it may be that the category of unfavourable is can be established in the sense of not cooperative or giving evidence contrary to the Crown case, but it's on the margin.
And for a moment, they're weighing up whether the prosecution will need to cross-examine its own witness. But ultimately, the judge decides it's too late for the prosecutor to do that, and they should just move on to the next witness. And the next witness is Rosie's mum, Lisa Hutchins, the Balmoral Bush nurse who picked up Elise from the caravan. She's the one who signed her police statement with the town cop, Jeff Barcham, and who told Jeff she didn't think Luke could have raped Elise. The prosecutor lobs a few opening questions and then asks how Elise seemed when Lisa got to the scene.
Are you able to say whether or not she was crying?
She appeared that she may have been crying.
Well, was she crying at the time?
She wasn't crying at the time. She was upset. I just supported her and popped her in the front seat of the car. She wasn't howling tears, if that's what you're asking.
Once again, a key prosecution witness appears to be giving evidence that's at odds with her police statement.
So she was crying at the time?
Yes, but it wasn't howling sobs. It was a tear on the cheek. So I think there's crying and there's crying.
Before he wraps up, the prosecutor asks Lisa an open question about what Elise had said to her that morning in the kitchen. From the prosecution's perspective, this is the headline moment in her testimony.
And what did she tell you?
Well, she said that she'd been raped. I can't remember exactly what she said, but the impression that I got was that there may have been a non-consensual event occur.
Lisa may have wavered in parts of her testimony, but on this point she's clear and consistent with her original statement. Elise had told us she'd been raped almost immediately after it had happened. We emailed Lisa Hutchins questions about her evidence on the stand and asked her why she appeared reluctant to say Elise was crying. She replied that she felt manipulated by the prosecution to present factual information in a way that was not accurate. And she said she was not provided with the opportunity to present information she felt was of importance. We also sent written questions to Rosie Hutchins about her court appearance and asked why her testimony appeared to be inconsistent with her police statement. Rosie said she felt stunned in the courtroom and was, in her words, trying to understand and process the hidden meanings of the questions being asked. "I felt attempts were being made to manipulate me into saying something," she said. "I just didn't know what that was." When asked whether they stood with the offenders outside of court, Rosie and Lisa both said they simply stood where they were instructed to.
After the prosecution wraps, the defence begins their case, and Sean Bloomfield is the first to take the stand.
Mr. Bloomfield, come into the witness box.
What is your full name?
Sean Philip Bloomfield.
Sean tells the court that he and Elise had a spark and that he never heard her say no. But he does accept that at some point when she pushed against his chest, he stopped. Elise had told the court in her testimony that it was Luke who'd suggested the threesome, and Sean is asked about this. At first, he denies that he heard anyone mention a threesome at all.
I did not recall that being said at all.
Okay. Is it possible it was said and you just didn't hear it?
It could have been possible, but like I said, I didn't hear it at all.
But then on cross-examination, he decides that actually a threesome was mentioned, but not by either of the men. Sean says that it was Elisa's idea.
Like, that's what I heard her say.
The prosecutor pounces on the claim.
You're saying now that Elise initiated this threesome. You think she's initiated it. She said, let's have a threesome or something to that effect.
Yeah.
It's a pretty clear green light to having sex, isn't it?
Yeah.
Why didn't you tell the court that when you were giving your evidence, when you were being questioned by your barrister?
It's just what we've been discussing. Like,
so is that your recollection now, that it was Elise who suggested a threesome?
Yes.
But when Luke Merrifull takes the stand, Sean's testimony falls apart.
We heard evidence about someone mentioning a threesome. What do you say about that?
At some stage I did mention that, yes.
All right. What then happened?
So pretty much just straight after I said I mentioned the threesome, I believe her and Sean started kissing from what I could sort of get a sense of.
Under cross-examination, Luke acknowledges it's the first time that he's admitted this.
Have you ever said that you didn't mention a threesome?
I think I did previously, yes.
And when was that?
I believe it would have been when I was talking to my barrister at some stage.
So you told your barrister previously you hadn't mentioned a threesome?
Yes, and then upon thinking about it, the whole incident further, I realised that I had.
Luke tells the court that soon after suggesting a threesome, he got on his knees and pulled Elise's jeans off, penetrated her, and then left the caravan. And when cross-examined, he continues to argue that Elise consented to this.
She said no initially.
I'll disagree with that.
She elbowed your arm away.
Disagree with that.
She was trying to roll away from you.
Disagree with that.
And she was trying to escape. It was clear, wasn't it? She's jammed between you and Sean Bloomfield, and she's trying to escape, isn't she?
I'll disagree with that.
But she was trying to move, wasn't she? She was trying to get out.
At no time did she seem uncomfortable or struggling.
But when the prosecution asks...
Why do you say that? What was she doing to make you think she was comfortable?
She seemed comfortable.
Just before he finishes his testimony, Luke is asked one more question.
Why did you leave the caravan if everything had been so friendly?
Obviously, I just thought I'd give Sean and Elise some privacy. I felt like I needed a drink of water. There's no point me sitting in the caravan after I've ejaculated, I don't think.
Once all the witnesses have been called, each side delivers their closing arguments. Luke and Sean's barristers tell the jury that what happened in the caravan was consensual and that Elise was just embarrassed afterwards and tried to rationalise it. They say she didn't want to be seen as a slut. To make this point, they lean on testimony from witnesses that were called by the prosecution, Rosie and Lisa Hutchins.
And then on the prosecution side, they say Elise said no, but she never gave her consent, that she was a truthful and reliable witness, and that what she told the jury is what actually happened. In a nutshell, the jury just needs to decide one thing. Whether they believe Elise.
Gentlemen, I understand we have a verdict.
The jury returns their decision on the charges one by one. It's guilty on all counts. There's audible distress from the courtroom as voices cry out in horror.
Please.
As the judge delivers his instructions, the crying out continues from the supporters in the background.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, the next part of this process involving you is very brief. I'll keep it as brief as I can. What we'll do is I'll just raise something with the family of the accused men. It's necessary that I move to the next part of the process. It's necessary that that happens uninterrupted. These are tense times, I understand. But please. Now, ladies and gentlemen.
Detective Alison Manicky Brown is there in the room watching this reaction.
I remember there was a lot of support in court for both accused at that stage. They were quite shocked that they were found guilty. You know, rape is a really harsh offence and it's a really harsh term. So being a rapist, and I think that people normally can't or naturally don't want to believe that people are capable of that.
Elise's brother James is in the ute. He's been working in the paddock with his dad.
It would have been mid-arvo. Or just after lunch, and we're on our way home. And we'd done a big morning shift of shifting sheep around, and Dad was in the passenger seat because he normally falls asleep in the afternoon when we're driving along, so I was going to give him a sleep, but his phone went off.
It's Elise's mum, and the verdict's guilty.
It was a huge relief, yeah, huge relief. I felt like everything that we'd been saying and we knew to be true had just been proven. It felt like all the unreasonable, like how we'd been treated so poorly and how we were saying stuff you to everyone, like it felt like we were proven, you know what I mean? Like we were in the right the whole way through.
It's the first time in a long time that James has seen his dad smile.
I think he cheered. I think he was very happy. Yeah, he'd been very stressed and down the dumps for a lot of it, but he was smiling, so that was nice. We were actually listening to Beast of Burden by the Rolling Stones, and I cranked it. It was good.
Elise is driving in the car when the news comes through. She's exhausted, but also relieved.
It was like the opposite of being overwhelmed. It was like all of a sudden there was like a weight was off my shoulders. It was just like I just felt like such a relaxing, like I don't have to keep screaming into the void that this actually happened. Like this actually happened. Just like allowed me to breathe a little. It felt like I didn't feel crazy.
When Elise gets home, she heads straight for bed. She thinks, finally, it's over.
I was trying to have some downtime and this message came through.
An old classmate who lives in the town is a few weeks out from her wedding. Luke Merrifull was going to be there. He's now in jail awaiting sentencing and the bride is seething. She sends through a note on Messenger. Congratulations on ruining two people's lives for your own immature mistake. You've known from the start that what you've been doing is wrong, but you were too far deep to say anything. I've known Sean and Luke my entire life and know they would never have done the things you've falsely accused them of. You've sent two innocent people to jail, and I hope you live the rest of your life feeling guilty for what you've done. Karma will catch up with you.
It was like the day we got home from court and I'd just gone through this trial and I was exhausted and I was fucked, but I was like, you know, at least we won kind of thing. And I remember I just opened it and it just broke me. I was like, you should be mad at him. He's the reason he's not in your wedding. Like, the misogyny is so ingrained that even the women in this community will put the men above themselves.
We contacted this former classmate to ask about the message. She said it was a long time ago and that she had regrets about sending it, but couldn't take it back.
Two months later, the men and their supporters are back in the Geelong courtroom to hear Judge Mullally's sentence. The courtroom is so packed that it prompts the judge to say something.
I don't normally come into a courtroom and see as many people in support of two young men as I see today. This is extraordinary.
Alison, the detective from Warrnambool, is also in the room. She's surprised to see such visible support.
I can understand the community support that they've received, whether it be right or wrong. You've got to remember a lot of this community are related and, again, have been friends for such a long time. So I think I understand that, but the support in regards to when the sentencing occurred, that did stand out for me and did surprise me.
Among the crowd are also representatives of the Harrow Balmoral Football Club, including the club's then president. Before the verdict, she'd given a character reference for Luke. She said he had a reputation for truthfulness in the community. Some of the supporters are from Luke's new home in Geelong, but they still have deep ties back to Balmoral. The former president of Luke's new footy club at Leopold, he grew up in Balmoral, and his father and Luke's grandfather were great mates. He takes the stand to give a character reference, and he tells the court that when he learned about the rape charge a few years ago, he left it alone.
I don't like to touch on those things. I like to leave those things. But the conversations I did have with Luke were about what went on, mate.
We weren't allowed to play his voice, so again, it's being read by an actor.
And he said that he felt that at the time his words to me were that he thought that the sex was consensual, so I left it at that.
And when he's asked about whether the rape charge caused him any concerns in terms of having Luke as a member of the Leopold Club...
I knew Luke's character. I knew his family's character. So I knew that Luke would be the person I think he is and still is now.
And he's asked if he'll return to the club when his time is done.
He'd be more than welcome. He'd be welcome in my house as well.
Despite this positive show in court, Judge Mullally still decides to send these men to jail.
For both of you, I have ensured my sentence is proportionate to your crimes, no more and no less.
Sean is given 5 years and 8 months in prison, with a minimum of 3 years and 4 months. Luke is jailed for 4 years and 10 months, with a non-parole period of 2 years and 10 months.
These were opportunistic crimes, but they were serious and selfish, where you put your sexual gratification above the ordinary human dignity and feelings of your once long-term friend. That is shameful, and the devastating impact on her is still resonating.
The men are taken back into custody, but within 24 hours, a prosecution witness comes forward. The witness has new information, information that will throw open the case all over again. Next time on Hometown Boys.
At the time, she said, oh, Luke maybe, but not Sean.
Once I calmed down, you know, then I got angry. Then I got really, really, really fucking angry. 'Cause that conversation didn't happen.
If you've experienced sexual assault and you need support, you can call Full Stop Australia on 1800 385 578. Background Briefing's sound producers are Lila Schumer and Ingrid Wagner. Sound engineering by Simon Branthwaite. Music composition by Emrys Cronin and Joshua Curtis. Fact-checking by Justine Landis-Hanley. Our rollout producer is Ben Spean. The supervising producer is Max Chalmers. And the executive producer is Fanu Falali. I'm Charlotte King.
And I'm Andy Burns. To hear more episodes, search for the Background Briefing podcast on ABC Listen. Thanks for listening.